Interestingly, sport's an area that, unlike some others, has really seemed to grow and become more and more professional, and there's more and more money in sport, I think, over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So people are much more willing, even with some of the sports not at the top level now, to take action to protect their rights and to litigate where necessary. Now, one of the key issues in the, one of the key topics which I've directed most of these slides to tonight in a sporting context is natural justice. And basically, a lot of cases come about, particularly in the sub-elite disciplinary proceedings, when a disciplinary proceeding's not run in a way that gives the person being disciplined a fair go. And it's usually about the process of what. So, because tonight's a CLE, and I need to focus on a legal topic as part of that, I'll try not to get into too much legalese depth about it all, but natural justice will be the main sort of focus because it's the most practically relevant, I think, topic of law within a sporting context. Then I'll also cover some what I see as a big threat to the integrity of sport, match fixing. I'll just make some observations about that, open it up for discussion. And I'm very happy to take questions as we go along, and for you to take me to topics that you're interested in that I may not have covered directly here. So you'll see that I've tried to split it up to say what natural justice is, when it applies, what happens if you don't provide natural justice, some observations for incorporated associations. A lot of sporting bodies are incorporated associations, so the Incorporated Associations Reform Act applies, and I was involved in a case there recently that was quite interesting, and also comment on appearing before tribunals. So you'll see on the third slide that natural justice is, it applies very broadly. You know, people often think just about a tribunal that you go along and there's a panel and whatever. It basically applies to any administrative decision which affects an individual's, directly affects an individual's, you know, rights, interests, or legitimate expectations. So the obligation to provide natural justice, or let's think of it as fairness, or it's called procedural fairness, in the way you discipline someone or the way you reach a decision that can adversely affect them, means that natural justice can come into play. If it's a statutory body, the law says, and this is, there's some cases there under the statute, but I'll keep it relatively high level. Law says if the Act gives you a power to do something that directly affects a person's, you know, livelihood or rights or legitimate expectations, then you must provide natural justice unless the statute very clearly says that you don't have to. And so the courts will infer this obligation on a body that has a statutory power, in the even if on reading it you wouldn't pick it up, because it's one of those sort of fundamental rights that they will imply unless it's explicitly excluded. Now, natural justice also applies in a non-statutory context. So if we think racing's typically a statutory context because usually the racing body is set up under an act, AFL derives all its powers, for example, NRL, Cricket Australia, it's all contract. There's no Cricket Act, AFL Act, you know, NRL Act. They rely on the what the player and the participants sign when you agree to become a player. That's the legal authority that you have over a player, a coach, a sports scientist, what have you. So in a contractual sphere, the law is a bit like in the statutory sphere. It says we will imply into your contract whenever you're making a decision that might affect somebody's livelihood, rights, expectations, we'll imply a clause that says you must give natural justice when you're making any of these decisions unless you specifically exclude it, right? And the danger with contract is where people try to specifically exclude it. And I had a case, you know, involving a basketball body a couple of years ago. You run a real danger, then you're in the restraint of trade territory. Because if you decide you want someone to sign up to say we're not going to give you basic fairness in disciplinary proceedings, you want to have a good reason for it, because otherwise it's an unlawful restraint of trade. And the DeBellin case, how many people have heard of the DeBellin case recently? So he's a state of origin 28-year-old star of NRL, and he got arrested over summer, not this one gone, the one before, and charged with very serious sexual assault of a 19-year-old girl. And they'd had a history of all these things. So the NRL changed their rules to say, we will, anyone who's charged with something, a serious criminal offence where you can go to jail 11 years or more, we are going to rub you out until the criminal case is finished, right? And DeBellin took that to the Supreme Court, and he said that's an unreasonable restraint because you're interfering with someone's rights in that context, aren't you, before they've actually had a proper hearing. And he said it was a restraint of trade, and the court received all this evidence from the NRL about what damage it was doing to their brand, their sponsors, television, juniors playing, for all this terrible player behaviour, that the court accepted in that context, with a lot of evidence to support it, that no, the NRL, yes, it was a restraint, but they were reasonable. It was reasonable for them to do that. And I should mention that they paid, they continued to pay him, and he could play, so he didn't lose his income, but he did lose the right to compete at the highest level for, you know, an indefinite period until the criminal case was resolved. So that was a really interesting example in the contract sphere where actually they were allowed to do that because they explained and had such good evidence to show why they needed to do it. That's the last case I refer to under contract under point two there. So the other, one of the interesting things about when natural justice applies is in the past people often thought that sport's sport and the law shouldn't get involved. And there was a High Court case of Cameron and Hogan, which wasn't actually a sporting case, it was more a political membership of a political organisation, where it established a principle that where there's no underlying legal right or contract, that the court won't just interfere if you've been denied natural justice. But over the years, since Cameron and Hogan, courts have become more and more willing to interfere and find a way to interfere where someone's denied natural justice. And Rose and Boxing New South Wales involved an amateur boxing referee who'd refereed at the Olympics. And, you know, he didn't even make his a living out of what he did. And he didn't actually have a contract with Boxing New South Wales. But they said, because of his role and the way that Boxing New South Wales was set up, there was intention to create legal relations, and they would interfere where they suspended this referee for 12 months because they had somebody who was involved in prosecuting him sit on the tribunal, which is a form of denial of natural justice, which I'll come to in a minute. So what do you have to do to give someone natural justice? This is the two pillars slide there. What does it mean to give someone natural justice? The first point to make is that the High Court's been very clear to say it varies from case to case. Like if you're the Go-Kart Association of Queensland, you don't have the same obligations as the Australian Football League, for example. It depends a little bit on the context, the livelihood involved, etc. But there are two fundamental principles that it nearly always comes back to. And one is the right to be heard. So the right to have your say before someone makes a decision about you that either to rub you out or affect you in some negative way. The second part of natural justice is the right to an unbiased decision maker. And law has potentially expanded in that area recently, which I'll come to in a minute. Now, if we think first about the right to be heard. You'll see a page, I've got a page there with a picture of Andrew Dunkley, the former Swans centre-half back, played on Carey in the 1996 grand final. So when I was an article clerk at Cause, a fellow who David will remember well, Grant Hattam, was my mentor. He acted for the Sydney Swans. And in grand final week, the AFL decided that Andrew Dunkley, in an incident, I think it was with James Hurd in the preliminary final, was going to face the tribunal on Wednesday night, and they didn't charge him until Wednesday morning.
I sat on the tribunal.
You sat on the tribunal, right. So back in the days where there was no legal representation allowed for players. And so we went to the, and I got an affidavit from the advocate. What's his name again? David, the Ian Finlay, Fingers Finlay. Yep, and saying that he was working all day and he couldn't, it was impossible for him to adequately prepare the case. And the Swans saying, we only found out about this Wednesday morning and we've got to fly down and we're preparing for a grand final. And Justice Hample gave us an injunction to say, we'll stop the AFL from imposing that suspension because it was a denial of natural justice. He didn't have the right to be heard. It wasn't enough notice to say, you've got to be here within that time to prepare his case, have a, he couldn't have a barrister, he had to go and use an advocate who couldn't prepare it in that time. It's a good example. A more recent example is Howard and Surf Life Saving New South Wales just last year, where a surf lifesaver was accused of harassment and physically aggressive conduct. So the Surf Lifesaving Organisation did an investigation into his conduct, and they made some findings, and they just basically gave him the investigation report and said, right, come before the tribunal, here's the investigation report. He said, well, but which parts are you saying that I'm guilty of? You know, the only one that the investigation report says I did was that I swore at somebody. They say it's inconclusive. They said, oh, you work it out for yourself. Court says, not good enough. You know, yes, you had a hearing, but he didn't know exactly what he was facing. There were five different allegations. They refused to tell him which ones he was facing at the hearing, and he knocked over the suspension on that basis. Racing case, Weber and Racing New South Wales last year. Again, this was a decision about whether a trainer should be able to be licensed. There was an allegation in the report, Peter Vlandis was involved in the decision making, to say that she had staff in her stables that weren't properly licensed, but they didn't tell her that that was one of the allegations. They told her the other things they were looking at, but they forgot to tell her about that one. So the court says, no, you didn't tell her. She didn't have the chance to come along and say why she wasn't guilty of that one, and that's part of your decision, and they knocked over the decision. And what they also said in that case, a related case, is you can't then turn around afterwards and say, oh, sorry, we forgot to let you know. We'll think about it, we'll do it again, because it's too late then, because you've made up your mind and you won't have a fresh opinion. So that's the case of Simiana that's referred to as another case from last year. It actually involved a trainer who got 16 years for a disqualification for using a substance like EPO, at least five horses, and they wanted to put conditions on his life. He got a stay, and then Racing New South Wales said, no, we're going to put, Harness Racing New South Wales said, we're going to put some conditions on your licence that about you have to come within an hour's notice, all these sorts of things, because they thought he was likely to reoffend. And again, they didn't give him the right to make submissions about that. They didn't tell him what the grounds were for what they were looking at, and he was able to get it overturned. And they said, oh, no, that's okay, we'll decide it again now. You can have your say. And the court said, no, too late. Request to call a material witness. So if you go along to a tribunal and you've got someone who helps your case, and you say, I want to call, I've got my friend Jack who can show, who was present when I was alleged to have done this harassment, and he'll come along and tell you it never happened. Some tribunals will say, no, that's too long, we don't want witnesses, da-da-da. If you refuse someone the opportunity to call evidence, again, that can be a denial of natural justice. You don't have to be there in person, So often you can do it just by giving the right to put submissions in writing. The other interesting part where a lot of sporting bodies occasionally get fall afoul of is you don't just have to give natural justice about whether they're guilty or not. You have to give natural justice about what the penalty should be, right? So if you say in the surf lifesaving example, okay, we find you guilty of physical assault of a fellow lifesaver, and we've decided to give you 2 years suspension, regardless of the fact that you've said everything you want to say about whether you're guilty or not, they can't then go and do that next step and stay 2 years unless they've given you the chance to say what you'd like to say about penalty. And another racing case last year was Sam Kavanagh, the Sydney Sam Kavanagh, is the son of Mark Kavanagh from Melbourne. And he, the racing appeals tribunal up there, said that in their penalty, we're going to give you these penalties for your cobalt offences. And there's a horse that had cobalt and caffeine in its sample. Right? And they said, okay, we give you, might have been 2 years for cobalt, and we're going to give you an extra 6 months for caffeine. And the Supreme Court said, no, you didn't give him a chance to be heard about whether the caffeine should be added on top of or be part of the 2 years or he already got. It was the same horse. So that was quite a strict approach of the court to submissions on penalty. So that's one thing for the decision makers to be very careful of, is that you give the chance for them to be heard on penalty. The next couple of slides are really about legal representation. There's no right to have a lawyer in any disciplinary case, but it's one of the factors, and you'll see the quote there from Keynes and Jenkins, that, you know, I suspect that one day there'll be a decision in a context where someone tries to deny someone the right to have a lawyer, and they will uphold a denial of natural justice. And particularly if it's a really complicated matter, or one that has the need to cross-examine witnesses, where a lawyer can really, or an advocate can really add expertise. But there hasn't been such a case yet. And in a lot of the basic cases, say the golf club or whatever, it's fine for them to exclude legal representation. What was really interesting with the AFL tribunal, when we changed the system and allowed legal representation, it actually made the process often more efficient and better, because the lawyers were better equipped at working out the relevant point and focusing on it. And that's what I was going to say about anyone appearing at these sorts of tribunals. I think that my experience is that they hate people waffling on about something that's irrelevant. You really need to work out first what you think is the key to the case and try and really be disciplined about focusing in on that issue. The appeals process is the next thing. So again, a lot of people think that you need to have a right of appeal to protect your procedure of natural justice. Not the case. So if you've got a really good first instance process, there's not really necessary to have a right of appeal, but I think it's a good safeguard. So there are cases where, even though they, let's say, buggered up the first instance hearing by not doing something properly, the fact that there was an appeal and they did it right the second time meant that there was no denial of natural justice. And there's a Calvin and Carr and Forbes examples there. Interestingly, what we did with the AFL system, the old system, used to be that you could have an appeal, you pay your $5,000 fee, whatever it was, and you have the case heard again. And then when we changed the system, and I think we improved the process, allowed lawyers in for the first instance, we said, you don't have an automatic right of appeal anymore, like an appeal de novo to have the thing all heard again. You actually have to show some error in the original decision. So the number of AFL appeals now is, you know, way, way less than what it used to be. There might have only been, say, 9 or 10 in the last 12 or so years since the system came in, because it's much harder. But it's a good safety valve to have there without having to go off to court. and what that Webb and Confederation of Australian Motorsport case was important about showed that where the contract says that you must exhaust your internal rights, Webb wasn't allowed to run off to court before he'd exercised his right of appeal because they drafted their rules well, and he was obliged to exhaust his internal right of appeal before he could go off to court. So that's the first part of bias and difference, is the right to, sorry, the first part of natural justice, the right to be heard. And then the second part is freedom from bias. Now, if you're a statutory decision maker, the law is very clear that it's not just actual bias in the sense that you've actually made up your mind. It's enough if a reasonable observer would reasonably think that you were biased or that you might not be impartial. So you might know somebody else involved in the case. You might have been involved in the prosecution or preparing the material that's gone to the case. You might have a financial interest in the organisation. All those sorts of things are called apprehended bias. Now, traditionally, and Maloney was an authority for this, it was thought that in private tribunals or contractual tribunals that you actually had to show actual bias. But there's a decision there, I think it's a very interesting one, of Agricultural Societies, Council of New South Wales and Christie, which it's reviewed all the authorities and basically said in that particular case, and this is a case where someone won an event at the Wagga Wagga show riding a horse, and their horse got drug tested, and he was rubbed out for a year because they had two prohibited substances. And the person who was involved in bringing the charge was the same person, and investigating was the same person who decided the case. Said, okay, I think you 1 year suspension for you. And he tried to challenge it, the fellow Christie, the rider, and the court said, we would accept apprehended bias is enough to for that tribunal, you know, a show, contract, horse riding, that was enough to be a denial of natural justice. That's a real worry for a lot of smaller level sporting organisations because they draw on their pool of people to hear their cases from their committee, you know, clubs, everyone knows each other, whether it's, you know, go-karting or local level sports, you know. So it's very hard for them, that decision, to comply with if they always have to show the tribunal doesn't really have a connection with the person being heard, because in a smaller organisation that's often difficult. The other interesting thing about that case though was that Christie lost, even though they said it would have been apprehended bias, because they went back to that old High Court decision and said, in this particular case you can't show that you had a contract with the society that comes in and does the drug testing and the disciplinary arrangements, so we're not going to intervene in sport in that example. So it's contrary to some of the other cases, but it was a little bit of a throwback to the old attitude of not getting involved in sport unless there's an underlying cause of action. Now, in the vast majority of cases, there'll be a contract. So it's academic, and if the sport is an incorporated association or a company limited by guarantee, the people are often members who are being dealt with, and there will be a contractual relationship. So interesting that apprehended bias looks like it might be extended to, you know, contractual tribunals as well. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's very attractive, particularly for those sorts of organisations, smaller sports, that they can have access to that tribunal. And I was talking to someone before, I'm trying to remember who we were discussing, that the AFL was, oh yeah, Jen was, yep. That potentially even, you know, the AFL was considering a presentation yesterday, saying they're considering using that tribunal for some of the drugs cases as well. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. But definitely from a bias point of view, very helpful. Yeah, yep. Good point. So, consequences of a breach. There's a slide there. Basically, the decision is void ab initio. You can also try to get damages, particularly if it's an organisation, and that was that Rose and Boxing case that is designed to provide for your enjoyment. So not only will the court give a declaration or wipe out the decision, but they sometimes will give you damages, such as, for example, a fine that was unlawfully imposed, or for the inconvenience of missing out on the use of the facilities, etc. And there's actually a case which indicates that you may even be able to get damage for loss to your reputation, a New Zealand Supreme Court case, which is controversial because usually that's defamation. So that'll, you will see over time whether that, so we've actually got a case that might test that in the next couple of years. Incorporated associations, I won't go into detail here. Just interesting that sports to be aware that a lot of them are incorporated associations, which brings the Act into play. And that Act says you can't engage in conduct which is oppressive, and disciplinary action can be oppressive, which denies natural justice. Or even if it doesn't, if it's unfairly prejudicial or discriminatory against a member, then the magistrate's court has jurisdiction. So it's relatively cheap compared with going off to some of these other cases in the Supreme Court to intervene and restore the members' rights. So I've given you a case, a basketball case I was involved in there, where a magistrate, Dandenong Magistrate's Court, involving a coach where Basketball Victoria had banned him for 18 months for bringing basketball into disrepute, and they denied him natural justice, and she used the Incorporated Associations Reform Act provision, that oppression provision, said there's a prima facie case and gave us an injunction to stay that penalty, and ended up getting that penalty set aside. Similarly, for companies limited by guarantee, there's a case of McCleverty and the New South Wales Carding Association, where oppression provisions of the corporations law can also be used in a disciplinary context to say that the conduct of your disciplinary proceeding is oppressive. In that case, a member of a go-karting association was held to be an underlying contractual right. The person involved in prosecuting it sat on the appeal, denial of natural justice, and the Supreme Court intervened. So, I think we've covered most of the topics except for, and we'll open up to questions and discussion in a minute, the emerging threat to the integrity of sport. And I wanted just to briefly mention, I think there's a massive threat to sport around the world, not just in Australia, from match fixing at the moment. And the sports betting market is globally is massive. It's estimated at $100 billion in 2017. And the vast majority of that is in what we call unregulated markets, say in India, where it's illegal to bet, but billions and billions of dollars are bet using the hawala system, which they just can't trace where the money's gone. And soccer as well in Asia, you know, companies based in the Philippines, frightening turnover, bigger than Apple, just for one of the betting companies based in the Philippines, betting on soccer. And because they're underground, they can't get monitored well, and there's massive money to be made when you can fix, not the whole outcome, because people have often said, oh, well, it would be so hard to fix a footy match or a cricket match or whatever, but you don't have to fix the whole match. You have to fix part of it, you know, and a part that, and because the betting's so big, particularly on sports like soccer, tennis, cricket, those ones in particular, you've got a TV going back into Asia or India and they're betting on it, there's a big market. And, you know, the Australian Crime Commission in 2000, as long ago as 2011, highlighted the increasing infiltration into Australian sport of organised crime. And then in 2013, another report warning of the presence of organised criminal identities and groups in the market for performance-enhancing drugs. illicit drugs, their interaction with professional players, and then that leads into match fixing, because it's like grooming. They just want to get their hooks in, whether it's information about a pitch or weather or whatever. They just have something on you, and often they'll offer, if they offer prostitutes or they offer drugs or they'll offer do anything to get the hooks in, and then it's very hard for the player to say no after that. And we saw, so the Bochum inquiry found 300 high-level soccer matches, originally started as an inquiry in Germany into illegal prostitution, organised crime, found 300 fixed soccer matches across Europe, including World Cup qualifiers. In Melbourne, we saw the Southern Stars. Does anyone remember the Southern Stars? You know, I think that's the level below, the two levels down soccer. Obviously being played on the television somewhere back, or the results being relayed back into Asia. You'd be amazed that the market that would bet on something like that, that they, and the lengths they would go to get players play for that club, to control the scoreline and so they could bet. And it's not always who wins, it's like how many goals are in the match or things like that. You had Oliver Anderson, the 18-year-old, I think he won the Junior Australian Open, playing in a Traralgon Challenger tournament, who threw the first set, and he was caught and suspended for, I can't remember exactly what his penalty was actually, but and with the proliferation now of sport, you know, also women's sport, you know, say women's AFL, soccer, all the different levels where sometimes people running the sport or whatever might think, oh, that's not as much of a threat. They're exactly the sorts of levels of the sport that the fixers will try to target, where they think that people aren't ready for it. And I know Cricket Australia got criticised a bit recently for one of the girls who plays in the one of the BBL teams released some selection information on her Facebook page or something, and everyone thought, well, that's a bit harsh compared with Stoinis, you know, whatever he did. But it's actually very important that they have a strong stance against disclosure of inside information, and because that's what the fixers prey on, and is a hook into the next level of involvement in match fixing, that sort of thing. So I thought a little bit of food for thought there too. And I don't think the general public, for whatever reason, maybe because it's such a bad story, but I'm a little bit scared for sport that the size and nature of this threat, and there's not a unified body trying to deal with it, because it goes across international boundaries, and it's such a great sport, a great crime to be involved in if you're a criminal, because you don't get sent to jail, you know, you get a fine. People don't understand how serious it is compared with dealing drugs, bringing in drugs across the border. It's a no-brainer to make your money out of if you can, if you're involved in organised crime. Last food for thought, which is not so much about integrity of sport or match fixing, was about, is a concussion is an interesting topic in sports law. I just thought I should mention that briefly, very topical at the moment. We saw, was it Polly Farmer, I think, and that had CTE. So there's, doesn't necessarily mean that it was because of his concussion injuries. We won't know for a long time, but there's a concern. I think what I worry about for the AFL is that by allowing the interchange to go unchecked and to increase the speed of the players and not rest, that they've actually increased the force of the collisions. And I know a lot of the coaches didn't want the interchange to be brought back, but by not doing that, I think they've allowed the pace and speed of the hits and collisions to go up, and there's a lever there that they could pull that they really should think about. Questions, comments?
How do you see the gaming industry being classed as esports affecting integrity?
Yeah, look, esports would be just as vulnerable as any other sport to, if not more, to integrity risk. In fact, I'm sure I was reading about a case where they had corrupted one of the esport tournaments or was fixed, because people bet on that as well, definitely. So, I mean, America had a big market for betting on that, on fantasy football, but now the US has opened up betting on the actual sports to make it legal in America, which is going to be very interesting. I think that's a smart move, by the way, because what we were saying before about unregulated markets, you want to be able to watch the betting. So the AFL is very lucky because a lot of the betting in Australia, they can watch it. So when we saw Nick Maxwell started at full forward in a game in 2011, I think it was, and there was a plunge in the betting from 80 to 1 to 20 to 1, Nick Maxwell first goal. So we were able to, who put on those bets? And we found a TAB and went out and saw CCTV footage of Heath Shaw wandering into a TAB to put, and then on the internet betting, we found Nick Maxwell's brother-in-law and family member betting. So it's not a major crime in itself, that, but it's, as I said before, that inside information is a very important safeguard from getting to the next level. So whereas soccer or football, whatever you want to call it, internationally, cricket internationally, chances of monitoring and finding out where the betting's being done, very hard. So the more you can get the betting in legal channels where you can watch it, that's nearly where you'll always best chance of finding if something's gone wrong, because the money talks. Someone will be looking to make money out of it and the odds will change. Yeah, well, I think they are two separate issues about the sponsorship and the integrity side of it, but it would be cleaner and easier if they had a stance to say, we're going to accept the money, we're going to deal with the sports betting companies for the point of view of protecting the integrity, so you have to have an agreement with us. So the worst thing they could possibly do is say, we're not going to have an agreement with any betting company, we're not going to take any money, because then they wouldn't get access to the betting information and the agreements. But so I think they need to do that. They need to have agreements with all the bookmakers to share information and to know who's put on what bets where and to pay a product fee. It's the sponsorship, which is the one that's a bit more questionable, I think. You know, do you need to have and be promoting, you know, Crownbet or whoever it is now as your one of your main sponsors encouraging the gambling on sport. It does get a bit of a mixed message, I think, in the public's eyes sometimes. Yeah.
Adrian, you talked a lot about the discipline from a regular point of view. What about discipline from within the club and what the clubs impose on players and sort of Dale Thomas having a drink, and then the more serious ones like the Izzy Palau type of issues. So what are your views around club imposed penalty?
Yeah, well, the same rules apply. So if a player wanted to challenge a club penalty for denial of, he could, or she could. So clubs, just like the sporting organisation, they need to be fair in the way they hand out the penalties. And sometimes, I think the players, often the leadership group, will get involved, and sometimes it may not be as fair a process, but generally the players cop it because it's their peers and they don't want to buck the system. But from a legal point of view, absolutely they've got the same obligations, offence, particularly sometimes, you know, where they rub them out or they fine them very significant amounts of money. Falau is a really interesting one. So De Bellin is the New South Wales Rugby League had their arrangements well in place and their contracts, etc., to be able to argue that he could be rubbed out even though he hadn't had his case heard. Sounds to me, for reading between the lines with Falau, that perhaps rugby union didn't have the contractual protection that they might have with Falau, because I would have thought that, just like with De Bellin, there's a very good argument to say if you've got someone out there who's a hero of your sport espousing attitudes or beliefs or discrimination that's directly contrary to what you want your sport to be about. You say, we want a game for everyone, we want everyone to play, and then you say, oh, gays, you know, whatever, what he said. Then that's, the sport should be able to, in my view, be able to say, no, that's not acceptable. If you're going to play our sport, we stand for inclusiveness, participation, whatever, that attitude's not acceptable. Don't play with us if that's what you want to say. I just think maybe they hadn't enshrined their right to do that well enough contractually. And we never know because it's obviously been settled. So they may well have won, I don't know. But that's the feeling I got from that case, was that they were worried about that their contract didn't protect them enough.
Off the end of that, how much then will players actually be like players then? So if a club has the autonomy to actually move them and say, you can't speak about this, you can't speak about that.
Yeah.
And for the players to actually, I'm so vindicated now to not say my opinions, to not follow my religious beliefs. So in essence then, essentially what should be in the contract is more we can have those opinions.
Yeah.
As soon as you go public about those sort of things.
Exactly.
And start, you know, flying off, then we're going to have to rein it in and make players aware of that. Because I think that's inherently what's missing.
Yeah.
The fact that, yes, you can have these opinions.
Yeah.
You can put it out there.
Yeah.
But as soon as you do in this context and you haven't checked with us first, then expect the consequences. And that's what was essentially missing, especially for these.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And in his case, I think he'd actually been warned as well about expressing those views publicly. So, yeah, I don't think...
But not in the first instance. Like, if it would... And to me, like, having come from a sporting background too and from signing contracts before, if that sort of behaviour and anti-bullying discrimination and everything is of the first instance in that contract and you are aware of it, that it will be brought into line and not just reading between the lines, as we say, then now we can target that sort of thing. So it's a shame to come to that, but in essence, that would be the ideal world, I guess.
Yeah, no, I agree. So absolutely, people should be able to have their own opinions, but if you're going to express it in a way that is discriminatory and contrary to the values of the sport, then that's taking it to another level.
What do you see changing contract negotiations, if anything, after this or as part of this? Have you seen a massive change?
I haven't seen. I mean, De Bellin is a good example of provisional suspension is a whole new area now. So the racing codes, I think, have had it for a while, and AFL, a lot of them that... where you, and I represented Harness Racing Victoria against a guy called Jack, who's one of the leading drivers, and he's been charged with race fixing. And he got a stay, he got rubbed out. He's got a criminal proceeding going, so they, Harness Racing Victoria said, we're gonna rub you out because such a serious allegation. He got a stay from the court to say, no, he's allowed, because he hasn't been found guilty yet. Court interfered with Harness Racing Victoria, and then eventually got convicted in the Magistrates Court of race fixing, and he appealed to the County Court because they do have an appeal de novo, and his barrister argued, well, because I've got a rehearing, I'm not guilty, I'm still deemed innocent, and he asked, and we challenged that to the RAD board and said, no, we want the stay lifted, and we got it lifted. He challenged it to VCAT, and the Deputy President Proctor upheld the right of the sport to impose the stay. So I think that area is an area of sort of evolving rules and laws about, firstly, about where someone's accused of something but they've not been found guilty yet. And secondly, I think sports, in view of the Folau example, would all be looking at their rules to say, have we got adequate rules and education about the rules as to what people can say on social media? They all get education about that, but whether they've got the rules to back it up, I'm sure they would have, all of them would have had a good look at that. And probably, I think a court would, if they do it properly, I believe a court would uphold their right to discipline someone for making a public comment that was like that. Yeah.
Adrian, sorry, just jumping back to concussion. I was interested in your thoughts in the discussion with Dr. Peter Harcourt, who's the Chief Medical Officer at the AFL. He was saying there's so much about the brain we don't know.
Yep.
There's so much about concussion we don't know. And yet there's court cases that are on foot about concussion, and he was talking about the level of burden of proof or so in medical terms, you know, it's up at the kind of closer to 100% in terms of medical proof.
Yep.
Whereas civil proceedings, the balance of probabilities.
Yep.
So with so much unknown about concussion, kind of what are your thoughts around cases that are happening at the moment with so much unknown?
Yeah. Well, the first point I think is that a lot of people just, I think, assume that it's established, that if you, that you get a knock to the head and that therefore, that concussion, therefore you get CTE, etc.
Yeah.
So that's still very controversial in science. So there's a lot of experts who say that you know, those cases of CTE might be from drug abuse or predisposition or other issues in that person's life. So, but it's a good point you make. For a doc, for someone to publish in a medical journal such and such cause is a much higher level, as you say, than in a... Yes, yeah. So polypharma, they, you know, say, but again, we don't know with poly whether there was some other cause or, you know, whether it was related to concussion. You sort of, when you hear about the stories about him sort of vomiting on the sidelines and coming back and playing, it sort of, you know, you sort of, your heart sort of tells you that there might be a link, but that's not the way that you, it gets, should or is, does get determined. But yeah, so on, look, the science is still far from settled on that. But I think, you know, the history of all things, like whether it's tobacco or, you know, gambling addiction or all the different things over time, has been that where there's enough smoke like that, I think their bodies just have to be very conservative and careful. And that gets back to what I was saying about the interchange before. You know, you can slow it all down a little bit and it still looks great as a spectacle, even better actually. Then the sports need to be thinking, what can they do to mitigate the risk?
Yeah, no doubt. But if you were going to launch a legal action, do it now when it's still unsettled, compared to when, if we actually know more, you might not be successful. If you are,
yeah, well, it depends what they find out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think encouraging the sporting bodies themselves, that sort of the band-aid sort of approaches, you know, the helmet.
Yeah.
How, and all those strapped on things, like sometimes that makes players just go gung-ho even more.
Yeah.
So just properly educating the people around in the contract, people, players,
yeah,
all different players in the contract, so to speak. Cause,
yeah, because when I was amused when that polypharma story came out, all these people the next day say, our club, we're forcing them all to wear helmets. And it's like, when I was at the AFL, the advice from all the experts was that helmets probably makes it worse because your brain rattles around inside there and you don't have the natural sort of protection and pain if you put your head in the wrong spot. So, yeah, there's a lot of myths and misinformation about it, but that's a big, the concussion's a big one, isn't it? You know. All right.
Any more questions?
Very good.
Thank you, Adrian, on behalf of everyone in Matrix. Thank you all for coming, and we'll see you at the next Matrix event, hopefully. Thanks. No, thank you. Just